Hello, everyone, and welcome to Managed Healthcare Executives Meet the Board podcast series, where we feature C-suite healthcare professionals once a month, and we speak about the most important issues in healthcare. In our Meet the Board podcast series, we spotlight a member of MHE's editorial advisory board so our listeners know more about our board members and their roles in healthcare. So be sure when you tune in to listen in and learn a lot. Hello, welcome to another episode of our Meet the Board podcast series. I'm Brianna Contreras, an editor of Managed Healthcare Executive. And in this episode, managing editor Peter Werwein interviewed Chief Clinical Officer of OptumRx and MHE Editorial Advisory Board member David Calabrese. In this episode, the two spoke about David's new role with the organization and his team's progress in improving quality, patient safety, and health equity in healthcare. David also highlighted efforts to address pharmacy deserts and medication shortages, and the two even discussed the challenges and future of retail pharmacies, the impact of cell and gene therapies, and the rise of GLP-1 weight loss drugs, noting their cost and scrutiny, and much more in the conversation.
Well, hello, David. Thanks for making time. You are one of our longtime and most stalwart editorial advisory board members. It's always a pleasure catching up with you.
Appreciate the opportunity. Good to see you again, Peter.
So last time we talked, it was about a year ago, you had moved into a new role, sort of out of a classic PBM role into chief clinical officer and dealing with issues of fulfillment and dispensing and supply. So how is this new job going?
Well, thanks for asking, first and foremost. I'm really enjoying it. Job's going well. I have a great team. We're fully staffed now, and I think we're making great strides over a short period of time and advancing some of the things we talked about the last time as far as our strategic agenda. In particular, we're very focused and have made meaningful progress in areas like advancing quality, advancing patient safety efforts across both the PBM and our pharmacy fulfillment footprint. We're building and piloting tools and resources to drive things like health equity advancement, leveraging the resources in our pharmacies, leveraging data and analytic expertise. We're innovating in areas like value-based care, analytics, new and different reimbursement models with the payer community as it relates to our pharmacies. We're supporting pathways to drive new and more meaningful clinically integrated support solutions through our pharmacies for patients with different types of chronic disease, rare disease. We're also making important strides in the area of promoting a more safe, more just type of culture for the staff that operates within these pharmacies. And that's just kind of a handful of the things I'm most proud of that we've achieved in, really less than a full year that we've been up and running as a new department. So proud for, where we are and proud of the team and what it's been able to accomplish.
So what is this, what are these health equity initiatives or approaches that you have taken? Designed to address pharmacy in the context of social determinants of health.
It's largely around that. It's, particularly given the fact that pharmacy is the most common touch point for most of us as it relates to healthcare, we want to be able to leverage those touch points, the relationships we're building with patients to collect more information around things like race, ethnicity, language, social determinants of health so that we can work with the payer community, we can work with community resources to close gaps for those patients, to direct patients to services and resources available to them locally, because we know how important health disparities can be in terms of impacting quality of patient care. So those are the type of things that we're doing now, leveraging the pharmacy resources to capture that information and to be able to partner with external entities, internal entities to close those gaps.
And has that ever been sort of across the board, or have you focused on conditions like diabetes, maybe heart failure, where it's a chronic condition where social determinants of health might have a
disproportionate effect? Yeah, it's not disease focused. It is more general. We're starting, and I think we talked about this the last time, one of the areas I represent as well is our Genoa Healthcare Pharmacy footprint, and that's 750 plus now pharmacies located, co-located often in behavioral health clinics, community health centers. And given the nature of the complex conditions, a lot of which are behavioral health, but also they range diabetes, cardiovascular, et cetera. Many of these folks are polychronic, many of whom reside in largely underserved communities. That's where we've spent the most amount of time early on in building these pilots and attempting to demonstrate the value that the pharmacy can have in collecting and influencing closure to those gaps.
Just one more thing. You mentioned patient safety. You know, in the context of pharmacy, one thinks about, you know, the wrong dose, even the wrong drug. Is that what you're grappling with, trying to squeeze out those medication errors? Or when you talk about patient safety, yep, you're talking about something different?
Yeah, that's a key component of it. It's one of the things that we did was we deployed a universal tool across all our pharmacies to be able to capture not just, you know, quality-related events, med errors, adverse events, but also near misses. Because I think near misses are what's going to help us identify how we can get better. How do we support, the clinicians that work in these facilities, you know, to try and automate solutions, to try and create additional checks and balances, policies, pharmacy best practices that can limit error. I think we do a great job, and our dispensing accuracy is at the highest possible level, but there's always room for improvement and there's always room to be more proactive. So, you know, by establishing a universal tool to report, that allows us universal capabilities to then analyze, identify trends, and then deploy quality improvement initiatives to try and address areas where, you know, there is that risk. So it's technologic advancements that we're investing in. It's performance-based metrics. And then, as I said, for this to work, we need our staff to feel psychologically safe in promoting transparency, reporting errors, reporting near misses, and feeling perfectly comfortable in doing so, that that's not going to be punitive in any way when they do so. So, that's the area of focus there.
Yeah, I'm aware of this sort of change in mindset. Thinking mm-hmm. they tried to make it occur with medical errors.
Largely emerged from the hospital community and now is being adopted more broadly across healthcare.
Now, you've referenced pharmacies, and I mean, the news about retail pharmacies in this country has been pretty grim over the last 12 months. CVS, of course, is closing hundreds of outlets. Rite Aid is bankrupt and closing hundreds of outlets. The retail pharmacy seems to be in serious trouble. And is that on something that's happening on, you know, affecting your remit, your turf, and What do you make of what's going on?
Certainly, I mean, that's an issue affecting the entire healthcare landscape, ourselves included. Our job on the PBM side foremost is ensuring that we do the best job possible preserving access in light of those dynamics you just described. And so on the PBM side, we're continuing to monitor these closures, identifying pharmacy deserts and trying to build upon our pharmacy network, which is, I think, 67,000 pharmacies strong now, to continuously refine that network, add pharmacies, close gaps wherever possible. Because access is critical. Access is what drives adherence. Adherence is what drives better health outcomes. At the same time, I think, consumers are becoming more comfortable now, more accustomed to having goods delivered directly to our homes. And with some of the dynamics impacting the retail environment, prescription home delivery becomes a much more acceptable means of service for the consumer. And as someone who's biased, I represent our home delivery service. I do believe it provides a very safe and reliable and now more digitally enhanced and connected experience for the people that we serve. And it can also address some of the barriers you described, with pharmacy deserts, closures, lack of transportation and patient mobility, and also some of the health equity challenges. It is certainly something we don't like to see, pharmacies struggling the way they are. We're doing whatever possible to work with them, support them. There are a lot of dynamics that I think are driving that industry-wide. Pharmacies has been well-publicized. There are staffing shortages, which are then requiring them to compensate employees at a higher rate. You've got staff burnout, you've got regulatory challenges, they're having to invest in technology and automation, cybersecurity protections, and then there's increased competition too, I think, at the retail level with, the grocers, the big box stores, hospitals, health systems, provider groups, even employers, building their own pharmacies. So, I think there are a number of things that are contributing to the challenges that they face.
So where do you see this headed? Some sort of mix? Are we just going to see fewer retail pharmacies because of these other outlets and because people are getting comfortable with mail order, and maybe we shouldn't mourn the passing of an old model? And just what's your
I think the closures are an effort to, I think, on behalf of the retail pharmacies, to try and operate more efficiently, to try and diversify their services in ways that are going to improve their viability. I don't think retail pharmacy is going away anytime soon, but we may see certain gaps, and that's where, organizations like ours can step in to try and help patients ensure that they still can preserve access, limit disruption, maintain continuity of care with the pharmaceutical services that they're receiving. I don't have a crystal ball in terms of, how much the retail environment will shrink over time. But I do believe that, that there will continue to be, adequate access with a, combination of the various types of pharmacy resources that remain.
Shifting gears a little bit, another thing that's been in the news is medication shortages. And I'm not sure whether this is a problem that you've been grappling with, and if it is, how have you dealt with it, and what do you see as the core causes of some of these medication shortages?
Yeah, I think myself and my team have definitely been involved in managing monitoring and addressing some of the shortages. We are one component of a multidimensional effort that we have here at Optum to deal with them and try and protect patients and, as I said, minimize disruption in care, which is a top priority. We've had to build out very comprehensive, almost daily market surveillance capabilities now to proactively assess, when shortages are occurring, when they're about to occur, where there may be supply disruptions. And when they are anticipated, we're now established with protocols, both PBM and on the pharmacy fulfillment side, to try and alleviate patient impact. So it's, on the PBM side, it's okay, let's identify what the equivalent therapeutic options are for patients. If we need to, we'll adjust formulary and utilization management efforts to accommodate that access. We'll support the providers and the members in ensuring that patients can be efficiently transitioned from one to another. On the pharmacy side, it's, that monitoring helps us to do advanced procurement of product and alternatives where necessary from suppliers to support whatever orders we have in front of us. We're trying to expand sourcing networks to be able to access additional product. We're, again, there leveraging our pharmacists and our technicians to help members transition to alternatives by working with the member and the provider. So variety of different efforts that we're undertaking, to try and adjust the problem. As far as the causes, I think there's a variety of different things depending on the therapeutic area. It's, changes in focus on the pharmaceutical manufacturers. It's access to raw materials from other countries where we have to source some of these things. It's regulatory changes, for example, within the controlled substance area, where we've seen significant shortages of drugs like ADHD meds. I would say there's a variety of factors that are contributing to that. Our job is doing our best to protect the patient when these issues do present themselves.
Have the shortages, you referenced sourcing networks, have the shortages opened up new sourcing networks, or do you see a new branch of the supply chain emerging in response to these shortages, or is it sort of working the system as is? I'm just wondering if something has emerged.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a lot of new sources for accessing medication as much as it is how do we better leverage what is available to us in terms of sourcing, whether it's directly from manufacturers, whether it's through distributors or other entities, to ensure as best as possible we can meet demand.
The does seem that cell and gene therapy is sort of cresting at the moment. Mm-hmm. It's been talked about for years, but there's just an increasing number of approvals. And the approvals are for conditions that aren't so exquisitely rare anymore, like sickle cell disease is just that much more common. Are you involved in cell and gene therapy distribution? And how is that sort of supply chain? What does that look like? And how does that differ from all the rest of it? I mean, it must be very bespoke.
Yeah, I mean, definitely involved. I think we touched on this as well in our last conversation. By my last count, I think we have now, to your point, around 18 different types of products now FDA approved here in the U.S. across multiple conditions. And it's a combination of, rare orphan disease, but also more mainstream, cancer, sickle cell, hemophilia, muscular dystrophy, those conditions as well. And, these are in many instances game changers with regard to, the potential to transform the lives of patients who are impacted by these diseases, as well as the caregivers, because many times they're pediatric illnesses. you know, genetically complex conditions. And, you know, it's, as I shared before, why our organization built out what we call Optum Frontier Therapy. So we have a rare and orphan disease pharmacy with a distinct set of capabilities specifically designed to support all the various stakeholders, the patients, obviously, but the caregiver, the provider, the payer, pharma, you know, through these challenges in terms of, you know, proper sourcing and distribution, cost management, complex administration. You know, many of these require very careful monitoring of the patient to protect them from a patient safety perspective, advanced analytics from reporting. And that's what, you know, this pharmacy is designed to do. So we have very specially trained clinicians in these pharmacies that know these rare diseases, as well as, you know, some of the others that these drugs are being targeted at. And it's a very high touch engagement, you know, with those various stakeholders, precision focused distribution, which is critical given the cost of these drugs, you know, minimizing delays and waste, and being able to share feedback on outcomes, you know, with the provider community, whether it's adverse events, drug interactions, or monitoring, you know, what we hope to be improved therapeutic outcomes, whether subjective or objective in nature, depending on how those are measured. So, yeah, it is you know, clearly a challenge, but one we're up for, and one that I think we do a good job in helping to manage and helping to drive, you know, what is, you know, ultimately the value of these products.
So are you also involved in sort of the value, value-based contracting for these products? Because, you know, the if you're going to do outcome pricing that's based on outcome, that requires monitoring the patients, making some judgment about, you know, there's going to be objective markers, but there might be also subjective things. Is that part of what you're involved in? Is
I don't do contracting directly with pharmaceutical manufacturers for these products. We have a whole separate team that manages that. But, you know, to your point, it is, you know, it's not uncommon for those type of arrangements to exist. And I think one of the values of being part of this, you know, large and diverse entity that is United Health Group is the fact that we have access to a much broader array of resources and expertise, data, et cetera, that allows us an opportunity to better engage in those type of agreements with pharma, you know, to drive value-based care.
So changing the focus again, and this is a little off the script, but I'm just curious about whether you see any policy or political development, sort of an exogenous factor, if you will, that's going to affect how, you know, how your part of the business operates now. Is there anything that you're tracking, a development, a regulation, that would affect you from the outside, so to speak? Yeah.
It's a great question. I mean, I think there's a lot of regulatory activity around PBMs, in particular, and how PBMs operate. There's a lot of activity around, you know, data sharing, patient privacy that we're closely monitoring. You know, I think our job is ensuring, as we always have, that we keep a close eye on, you know, what's taking place both at the state and at the federal level, and ensuring we have proper mechanisms in place, you know, to adapt as we need to those changing regulations, you know, to ensure, you know, that we operate in a fully compliant manner. That's a big part of my job, is in particular on the pharmacy side, ensuring that we are fully prepared in terms of regulatory readiness, compliance, you know, with regulatory policy, ensuring our pharmacies are well equipped, you know, with consistent policies and procedures and best practice to ensure that we're operating at the highest possible level of integrity as it relates to regulatory changes. So, you know, I don't know if that answers the question, but yeah, that's what my team is engaged in.
I can see GLP-1s being a challenge from a payer point of view and mounting expense, but I'm not sure how that affects what you do in your current role. I mean, it's just, so I don't know. I guess I wasn't sure how to pose the question in a way that.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's probably the hottest area of focus, not just for the PBM and for the payer community, but it has significant implications for, you know, the drug supply chain as well, our pharmacies. You know, given the demand, given the price point of these products, the lack of discounting, you know, it creates a lot of challenges, often pushing, you know, our pharmacies into the red in dispensing these therapies. And, you know, it's only going to grow. We know that the demand will continue to increase. I think I've seen projections that, you know, we could see 2-3-fold increase in demand and utilization of these products over time. And so, you know, PBM side, we're doing our best to kind of thread the needle and balancing consumer demand with our plan sponsors and their budgetary realities and challenges. We're trying to support pharmacies in the effort to, you know, defend the value of, you know, the reimbursement models. You know, we're launching programs to better support the patient because the drug itself is not a magic bullet. You know, these patients need to be, you know, surrounded with additional support as well, flexible support to, you know, to improve, you know, not just, you know, having a drug on board, but also, you know, lifestyle changes, nutrition, diet, exercise, et cetera, counseling, coaching where necessary, digital tools. And so, you know, it's a challenging dynamic and, you know, one that I think we're going to continue to grapple with over the next several months to years.
You said pharmacies in the red?
Pharmacies can be in the red. Distributors can be in the red. It is a, you know, that's the market. That's the dynamic we find ourselves in now.
How does it put you in the red? Or put a pharmacy in the red?
Yeah. I mean, if the pharmaceutical manufacturers aren't discounting these drugs to significant degrees, and, you know, reimbursement rates are aggressive now with what we offer to the payer community when we service their members, it could put us in a negative position in these products. It's not universal, but it's, you know, not out of the ordinary either, and it's not unique to our pharmacies. It's, you know, I think, you know, the chains, the independent pharmacies, I think everyone is grappling with this.
So they're a bad deal, even though it's more customers. It's like, what's that old joke, you know, about more customers, but if I lose money on every customer, it's, you know, it's not good business.
It's not a good business. No, it's not. It's not a good business situation currently.
Do you expect that to change? I mean, if they're not offering discounts, that's probably a symptom of lack of competition. And I think there's,
well, yeah, I think demand is driving that. This is a, you know, this is a, you know, I call it kind of a perfect storm. You've got the emergence of a probably our most effective class of weight loss drugs we've ever had in the US, right? Or worldwide. These drugs work. We've got a growing obesity epidemic. 7 out of 10 adults in the US are either obese or, you know, overweight. You've got overwhelming news, social media coverage, which is sparking demand. You've got now the emergence of evidence to suggest, you know, longer term cardiovascular benefits. And then you've got extremely high unit costs. Well, pharmaceutical manufacturers don't necessarily have to discount in a situation like that, because the demands are already there, and it's difficult to not provide access to these therapies on the part of the payer community. So it's a challenge.
Interesting. Interesting. So are you developing sort of weight loss programs to wrap around these? Is that part of
Yeah, for sure. We launched a program we call Weight Engage, and that's designed to do just what I said. It's, comprehensive, flexible weight management, wellness solutioning. It's designed to make sure right patients have access and coverage, helping to manage the cost aspects of this therapy for the clients, and simultaneously, as best as possible, promote optimal therapeutic outcomes with the agents. So, we've got different options that our clients can pick and choose from in terms of the components and what works best for them, what best tailored to meet their needs and the needs of their membership.
Are these programs designed primarily where you have to do a program before you get the drug, or is it sort of is the drug packaged with the?
Yeah, they go hand in hand. So, we have programs that are more provider guided, and they're not all internal. We're partnering with other organizations externally, to make sure that the consumer is, supported by key specialists, provided, a pathway to the most clinically appropriate treatment for them, is supported through coaching. We've got consumer driven solutions with coaching. We've got wellness support. As I said, digital tools that can be combined with also traditional utilization management efforts on the pharmacy side. So, again, it's multidimensional, and again, it allows our clients or plan sponsors to be able to pick and choose the components that work best for them.
Do you have any sense that this is a bubble that might burst? I mean, there's so much, hype on this. I think there's some evidence that a fair number of people leave these drugs after a while. Do you see any sort of pendulum swing in the works?
I think with time, things will sort themselves out as they always do. I think with time, you're going to see more competition, and, competition is good. Some of the older products, GLP-1s like Victoza, are reaching patent expiration. These aren't new drugs. They've been on the market since, I think, 2005, was the first one introduced. And so, I think increasing competition, development of more options will help to drive down, some of the inflationary challenges. I think you're right that there is a high discontinuation rate on these therapies because of the GI tolerability issues that come along with them. I think we're learning more about them and the most appropriate use, who's going to benefit most from them, who may not. We're doing a better job monitoring and intervening on inappropriate use, because I think what we saw was, folks manipulating the system to gain access to these products in situations that weren't necessarily clinically appropriate. So, cosmetic use of these products. And so, I think we are gaining better control. But the demand is still going to be there for some time. And, hopefully, we'll see some improvements on behalf of pharma in terms of pricing and discounting. I think the pressures are mounting at the regulatory level. I think I just saw something today where, these manufacturers are going to go before Congress to talk about the pricing. And I think they're going to be under pressure to, to take a look at how they're pricing these products, how they're discounting these products. You've got public entities like Medicaid and Medicare now that, because of the cardiovascular outcomes data, are going to be in a situation where, they're going to have to cover these products now, which is going to have a significant impact on budgets statewide and federally. So a lot of factors there that I think will hopefully help to shrink that bubble as you described it.
Thanks for tuning into this month's episode. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts, and follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Instagram. For more information on Managed Healthcare Executive, visit us at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.